Welcome back to East Meets West with me, Olga Bataman.
Tara Reid here. How are you, everyone? It's been quite a last couple weeks since we've been together. And in that time, Donald Trump decided to continue, although he said it was going to be 24 hours, his carpet bombing of Iran. And Israel's been carpet bombing Lebanon.
Yes, all the Lebanon is carpet bombing.
And with no real specific ending in sight, and it's been quite shocking
to the world. It seems it's been prolonged for at least a month already. They got stuck, as they always do.
Yeah, in quagmire.
But let's better discuss it with our compelling and extraordinary guest we're having today, Karin Kneissl, former Minister of Foreign Affairs of Austria, now lecturer, co-founder, and head of the Gorky Center here in Russia. Karin, it's really an honor and pleasure having you on our show.
Great to see you.
Thank you very much, dear hosts, Olga and Tara, for having me on your conversation.
Karin, let me ask maybe with the most essential question in the very beginning regarding U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran. As for you, what is the ultimate goal of this attack? Because you know what we've heard? This nuclear bomb is just ridiculous, and I guess no one is ever buying it. Even the regime change, I think that the... Well, while we see bombing of elementary schools, of the biggest private hospital in Tehran, so it doesn't fit the narrative of caring about the Iranians, you know, and getting rid of dictators, because they honestly don't care. It looks like a genocide.
Yeah.
So as for you, what's the ultimate goal of this attack? Because some experts, for example, say that the ultimate goal is energy domination, and they're trying to counter China in this way, since China is the biggest consumer, the biggest buyer of Venezuelan oil and oil from Iran. So now we see what's happening with both of these countries. Or maybe the goal is even broader, is even bigger. As we've heard Ambassador Bakabee, saying that Israel has biblical right on all of the land from Nile to Euphrates. So what do you think? What is the ultimate goal behind these terrible attacks?
First question on the geopolitical dimension, I would agree it's all about denial of access to the Persian Gulf with regard to the People's Republic of China. When we look back into the oil price crisis of 1973 or the 1980s, when there was a horrible war of attrition between Iraq and Iran, there was not yet an economic power called China on the map. But China was still in some sort of isolation. But now, of course, China, as not only as a consumer, but China as an investor and as a geopolitical actor, plays a role in all that. So definitely, I would agree with the voices you quoted. It's about denial of access to China. This is number one. When it comes to the topic of regime change, let me take a reference to the well-known quote of legal philosophy, the king is dead, long live the king. Le roi est mort, vive le roi. What does this mean? It means that any person who assumes an office is just an organ. And this organ, this person, can be replaced at any time. So when you assassinate a president of a country, or in this case, a spiritual leader, the supreme revolutionary leader in that case, it's not that he is unreplaceable. He was replaced by a vote. The new supreme leader, the son of Ali Khamenei, Mojtaba Khamenei, was allegedly injured in the attack on the house where his father was killed. And I read that he also escaped an assassination attack just a few days ago. Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel already announced that he will have him assassinated. So let's assume that there is another assassination. This will not change much because he is just an organ. The king is dead, long live the king. So all this talk about regime change doesn't work. You know, and the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran is quite strongly rooted. I would dare to say that around 25% of this 90 million population are behind the government. Why? Because they are deeply involved in the government. They live on the business of the government. And 25%, this is more support than German Chancellor Merz has within the German population. So the regime is fairly well anchored in the population. This is number two. Number three, you quoted the U.S. ambassador to Israel and this greater Israel concept, Eretz Israel, going from the Nile to the Euphrates. I had been working on the topic when I did my dissertation at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in the late 1980s. I had a scholarship there. And I met inter alia Yehuda Blum, who served as Israeli ambassador to the UN Security Council, to the United Nations in New York in the 1980s. And he was one of those voices. He actually had also a publication on these biblical borders of Israel. And I interviewed him for my PhD. And in those days, I'm speaking of 1987 when I worked in Israel, it was still a marginal opinion. Nowadays, it's not anymore a marginal opinion. Even Yair Lapid, the opposition leader, coming from a labor background, you know, the labor people, secular people, they never had anything to do with this kind of biblical interpretation. If I may quote here, the late Itzhak Rabin, who was assassinated in 1995 by a radical Israeli, he accused the settler movement of abusing the Bible as a kind of land registry. You know, wherever the 12 tribes of Israel have settled, there's a claim to Israel. Now, nowadays, you have even Yair Lapid, so to say, even whatever remains of the secular labor parties, who were always Zionists in a sense of security arguments, but not religious arguments. Even he would say now, well, if it serves the interests of Israel, it's fine. We are fine with this argument. I would like to add to this concept of Greater Israel, Eretz Israel, as opposed to the idea of State of Israel, Medinat Israel, which is a totally different nation concept. It would result only in imperial overstretch. Let us remember the time between 1967 and 1973. What happened in June 1967? Israel, surprise, surprise, took the Golan Heights, took the West Bank, took East Jerusalem, etc. Thanks to good intelligence, thanks to sort of blitzkrieg they managed. But between 1967 and 1973, they simply did not manage to keep the so-called Barlev line, which was on the eastern bank of the Nile River. They couldn't keep it. They were overburdened with that on a military level. So in 1973, in a combined effort, very astute attack by the Egyptian and the Syrian armies, the so-called Ramadan War or Yom Kippur War, they retook the Sinai, and they were about to retake other territories if the U.S. had not intervened on the side of Israel. That was the first time the Americans really intervened in favor of Israel. Now, imperial overstretch is something that the Israelis are already facing on a demographic level. But this is another topic, because there are, in this Jewish state that was done for a Jewish majority, you risk to not anymore have a Jewish majority for various reasons. One reason is that there's a huge wave of emigration, not immigration, into Israel. Let us also remember all those Russians, especially singers, intellectuals, and others who in spring 2022 said, oh, Russia is such a horrible place. Let's move to Israel because it's a very good place. Many of them have double citizenship. Many even registered their children who were Russians as Israelis, which means that these children will have to do their military service in Israel in the next 2-3 years. So all those who claimed that Israel is such a peaceful place, ever since 2023, they started to emigrate. And now you have more and more emigration from Israel. So these are the three answers that I can give to your first three questions.
So it seems that they failed the United States failed. And you know, the Spectator and other media outlets, now they're spreading these memes that call it epic fail instead of epic fury, you know, this right. operation. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it speaks for itself. They got stuck because they were hoping that once they dismiss or kill or assassinate the leader of the country, the people will rise up and would go into the streets, and then there will be a regime change. But what happened was the opposite, that people went into the street, but they went into the street to show their protest and to support the new leaders. So it seems they got completely stuck, and that's not for the first time. In Afghanistan, they went through exactly the same thing. When they mm-hmm. didn't have a plan B, they stayed there for 20 years. It costed trillions of US dollars. And Afghanistan, I mean, this operation brought them nowhere. So it seems it's a template. They're getting stuck in every country they go.
I think, too, that it has to do with the $1 trillion military budget in the U.S. And now Trump is asking for $1.5 trillion. And bear in mind, Karen, you probably know this, that the Pentagon has flunked their audits 6 times in a row. Jeffrey Sachs is someone who predicted that this would happen, that Iran would happen, that it's been the plan for a decade. Doesn't matter who's president. There's a plan. And one of the sticking points was the issue of online currency. Iran refused to go under the Rothschild, under the banking system, European banking system, and participate in that. And so that was one of the sticking points. From your perspective, what's kind of shocked me is the silence from the European community about the wanton just disregard for civilian life and mm-hmm. how they treated Russia. I mean, to the point where they weren't allowed to participate in the Olympics. They weren't allowed to, classical composers were removed. Russian classics were removed. I mean, the whole global community came down on Russia, as you pointed
sanctions
out earlier.
And everything.
And
yeah.
sanctions, of course. What is your thought about the silence or even the enabling of the U.S. To cause such violence against civilians in other countries right now, particularly in Iran and in Gaza? What's your thoughts on the silence by the Europe?
And the death toll only at the elementary school is over 170 innocent girls
right.
now. And there is no reaction from any U.S. officials whatsoever,
no.
European officials, neither.
Even when they were faced with the evidence that it was a U.S. Yeah. missile, a Tomahawk.
And I mean, it was definitely deliberate because
yeah.
there were 2 strikes, not
right.
even one that could be
yeah. Yeah.
a mistake.
Yeah. So let me answer that before going into the silence on the killing of children. There was not a single statement except Spain. And Spain had been immediately threatened by Washington that all kind of trade between the U.S. and Spain would be stopped. But if you want, to a certain extent, the Spanish government is the only one that is saving, in inverted commas, the honor of mm-hmm. what once upon a time was something like a European concept of fairness, justice, whatever. But this is one thing. I would like to answer your question from a different angle with your permission.
Yes.
Between 2003 and 2015, it was all about the EU brokering a nuclear agreement with Iran. Mm-hmm. And the EU always was very proud to say, well, this is our big diplomatic success story. We brokered this agreement. Well, in the end, it was all about the Obama government, and it was actually John Kerry and then Iranian Minister of Foreign Affairs, Javad Zarif, mm-hmm. who got very well along with each other and who made it happen. It was that 2015 in July, JCPOA, which is the acronym for this nuclear agreement with Iran, was signed. What was the idea of this agreement? It was the control of nuclear enrichment, and it was all about lifting sanctions and opening up the Iranian market. Everybody from London to Vienna to Paris was just like eager to jump on the Iranian market. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Iran, like the big partner you have to do business with. Now, what is interesting in inverted commas, once again, is that the same politicians, I'm thinking here of some Germans and Austrians, who were then so happy, so proud of this agreement, they would say today how wonderful that this horrible Islamic Republic establishment is attacked and that it's about to be gone. You know, the same people. So those who want, who were eager to jump on the Iranian market, earn money, make business with the mullahs, they didn't mind who was there. Main thing was about selling German commerce, bringing in tourism, etc. So this was only 10 years ago. If this agreement had really been implemented, if there had been an opening of the Iranian market, if there had been a lifting of the sanctions, which never happened, and then in 2018, Trump withdrew from this agreement, then the situation today might be different. We cannot tell which one, but the socio-economic situation in Iran would have been a different. I mentioned that because we have a kind of a very coward and hypocritical attitude by many, many EU governments, by many think tanks and experts who were all applauding the cooperation with Iran still a few years ago. And these same people would today say, wonderful, the supreme leader of the government is gone. Wonderful, they applaud. Yes, the establishment has to be killed. You know, this is what intrigues me a lot. And if I put myself into the shoes of an Iranian, whether civilian or official, honestly, I would say, why should I trust these people? Why should I sit down and negotiate? So from this stems, and I fully understand the Iranian position on that, stems the Iranian response to the offers, and there were offers by Washington, mediated maybe by Russia, but there were offers by the Americans over the last few days. Let's sit down and broker a ceasefire. The Iranians said, we are not interested.
No.
And this I understand, because it's not only that they were attacked on the 28th of February after there had been talks on the 26th of February in Geneva. Exactly. Foreign Minister of Iran announced on the 26th of February, in 4 days we will meet again at the International Atomic Energy Agency to continue. And then on the 28th, you had this attack. We had such a situation also in June 2025. And there were numerous betrayals also before. Mm-hmm. So from an Iranian side, I understand that they're not interested in negotiating. When it comes now to this tragic human dimension of the war. Not only that more than 150 schoolgirls were killed because the U.S. Military forces U.S. Air Force is using outdated maps, just like they used outdated maps, let us remember, in Belgrade in 1999 when they bombed the Chinese embassy because they had outdated maps. So how do they want to wage a war with outdated maps? This is number one. And as you said, they attacked this place of the school twice. Yes, this was a huge war crime, and there were many, many other war crimes. And there was this terrible environmental war crime by exploding the oil reserves, the oil tanks close to the capital. By the way, Trump called Netanyahu and told him, don't continue firing on the oil tanks. Why? Because we, the United States, would like to take over the Iranian infrastructure. We want to make money with it.
I want to interrupt you right there just really quick, because let's go back to the school. There is reports now that the children at that school were actually the daughters of officials, and that the U.S., it wasn't outdated maps, that they actually targeted the daughters of these officials on purpose. And the reason why there's such outrage as this is it's basically the U.S. has crossed that international line of taking out the innocents on purpose to demoralize. What is your thought on that, if it is true? And that was verified by Tucker Carlson and some other, Max Blumenthal, some other investigative journalists, that the school was actually, these were officials' daughters.
You know, I mean, whether these children were not the daughters of officials or of regular Iranians.
For yeah, me, it doesn't matter. Yeah, working space. Yeah, whatever. Still horrific.
I would like to elaborate on this question because for me, a child is a child, and whether this was the child of a not official, it doesn't make any difference. Sorry. This is my human attitude, so I can't elaborate on that. The other thing is that when we remember in June 2025, when the attacks started by the Israelis and then accompanied by the Americans, what happened in the first days of the attacks in June? About 200 of Iranian scientists and officials were assassinated in their bedrooms, in their offices, in their kitchen, in their bathrooms, because by some sort of remote control device which had been installed there previously by saboteurs, by spies, and there are thousands of spies running around in Iran, like in other countries, they were killed by remote control, by some sort of mini drones or other devices that were in their private rooms. And together, along with them, their children were injured or killed, their wives were injured or killed. So, first of all, this is not for the first time. And again, it's human beings. And whether this is now a nuclear physicist or whether this is a school teacher,
It doesn't make a difference. It's still it's a crime. It's a war crime.
I don't understand why people make investigation on this topic because it doesn't make a difference.
Karen, since we're discussing like family members, let me also ask you, because it was not only the supreme leader who was killed in his residence, but there were a number of his relatives killed there as well. And now we have the supreme leader whose father was killed in the U.S. attack, U.S.-Israeli attack. His wife was killed. His sister was killed. His nephew was killed. So like half of his family was exterminated. Of course, there is a line of consequences, so to say, but will it have any consequence on the line of his behavior? Because he's the person who lost not just his father, but who lost almost all of his family.
Right.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if you put yourself into such a situation, of course, you know, first of all, it's a shock. And that's a shock endures for some time. When you have been bombed. I know this kind of shock situation. So it's a shock that stays with you for a while. It doesn't go away after 48 hours. And as I said in the beginning, when you asked me about regime change topics, you know, he already escaped probably another assassination attempt. Right. He himself was capable of that. So he's living under existential threat. So this also makes something with you. And maybe he is ready to also become another martyr. Maybe this is really in his deeply rooted in his heart. I don't know. There are many people who think like that. And I lived in Lebanon for a while. I think I know Iran a little bit better than I know Russia. So I can understand this kind of consciousness. But this makes it only more difficult for a cynical approach, whether this is Israel, whether this is the US or the European Union, to make Iran implode, because this is what they want. Now, what could be the outcome of that? Either chaos or a very solid Iran that says we will fight to the end. And I think I'm not mistaken that Iran can fight a war of attrition. Because Iran fought a war of 8 years of attrition with horrible situations in the 1980s. I remember very well the bombing of Iranian cities by the Iraqi army under Saddam Hussein. It was Saddam Hussein who started that war. And his arsenal was full of chemical weapons he had received, for instance, from Germany, from France. I remember a cartoon in 2003 with Rumsfeld, the then Secretary of Defense. In this cartoon, he was just, unpacking a big box. And he said, I know that Saddam Hussein has got weapon of mass destruction because we still have the bills. So in the 1980s, they all provided horrible weapons, from chemical to bacteriological weapons to Iraq, in order to fight Iran, because everybody was afraid of the export of Islamic Revolution topic. Now, Iran, the Iranians survived that war. I met the survivors of those war. You know, these are not the clergy people. These are the people in the army. These are the people in certain militias. And this is a generation of my age. You know, they were born in the 60s. So these people have already been shaped by a tremendous experience, war experience. So why should they be afraid of some carpet bombing by the US or by the Israelis? And let me add to that a very important factor, which is totally underestimated by whoever plans this strange war by the US and Israel. Everything the Iranians use is made in Iran. Everything. Ammunition, drones, uniforms, shoes, everything. And you have Iranian soldiers. When you look into the neighboring Arab states, which are now under attack, and it's not the states as such, it's the U.S. military bases which are there under attack. And the war goal by the Iranians, if you want, is to get rid of all the U.S. presence in the region. That is their war goal. So that's why they are bombing 12 states. Those countries had to understand now that the U.S. is not going to step into the trench and so to say, fight until the last U.S. soldier for the survival of the United Arab Emirates or whoever. And this, I think, is something that comes maybe as a surprise. For me, it doesn't come as a surprise. I've been explaining in my briefings, in my lessons, that for 20, 30 years, when you have a state that does not have its own army, that works with mercenaries, be they from Pakistan, be they from Nepal, these people are there on a contract basis. Mm-hmm. They can leave whenever the contract is over. The Iranians are not fighting on a contract basis. They don't get money for that. They are fighting for their country. And they will fight until the very last man. So unless there is something like, I don't know, a horrendous bloodshed, we cannot exclude anything. We cannot exclude a nuclear scenario, for instance, unfortunately. Mm.
I was actually going to ask you, because just the other day in his interview to Tucker Carlson, Douglas MacGregor, who was involved, you know, in planning the military operations in former Yugoslavia and in Iraq, he said that it is possible that Israel may use nuclear weapons, and we see this. The stakes are really going up. And France, if you have heard, also announced the possibility of temporarily stationing their nuclear-capable aircraft abroad. So it seems that the stakes are going up. Where do you think it will bring the not just the Middle East but the world? Because I mean, now so many countries are involved. United States are evacuating stuff from their embassy in Saudi Arabia. So it's like really escalating. Will it slide into a full-scale war?
Yeah, I wanted to tag on that and add to the question about that, because remember when the Western media was pushing a limited nuclear war, they kept using the terminology limited nuclear war, and you know, President Putin said something very wise. He said there's no limited nuclear war, it's nuclear war, and no one wins. But that was the opinion of the general population and before, but we seem to be in a new time. Do you think they're, so tagging on our question, are we moving towards that? Would they be crazy enough to think a limited nuclear exchange is possible?
Well,
from the U.S.
I've been going to Iran for many, many years, every year, and I've been following this different scenarios that have been in the different drawers, you know, ever since 2003. I remember in 2000 when President Khatami was around, there were huge demonstrations against him. There were huge demonstrations against the concept of the Iranian system, and he could not help his own supporters. You know, he was like the darling of the West, Khatami, but he could not help his own supporters. And so scenario planning for Iran to invade it, to bomb it, there had been many, many. It's not only right now that we have this full-fledged war going on against Iran. And whenever the scenario planning came up, people discussed allowed, not behind closed doors, the use of so-called mini nukes, because ever since 1945, ever since little boy was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the United States, the little boy and fat man, I think, the two nuclear bombs that were dropped by the United States, ever since, no nuclear bomb had been dropped. And of course, we have today different generation of nuclear arms. We have the so-called strategic mini nukes. And there are many, many people, especially in the United States and Israel, who are more than eager to just test them, to experiment them. So for the last 20 years, I was sitting in so many expert panels where this was loudly discussed, you know? It's disgusting.
Yeah,
but they did. And so I don't want to dwell more on that, because first of all, it's an old topic. To my knowledge, it's a 25-year-old topic, quarter of a century. And on the other side, you know, why should we now speculate on that? We have, I think, to help our audience, whoever is interested in listening to this talk, we should better enlighten them or help them to understand what is the current outcome of that. And the current outcome is a tremendous disorder, which affects the energy market, which has an impact on each and every household. And I think these are the things people would like to try to understand. Nuclear scenario planning, I hope it doesn't happen, but hope is not the best guidance.
Yes, I was actually going to ask you about economic consequences that everyone is already facing. And from what I know, a number of states are already decreasing their oil production, so which leads to the fuel crisis. And some experts compare it to the fuel crisis, to the oil crisis of 1973. May it be of the same scale or higher. So you are the perfect guest to comment on energy markets. So where do you think this situation is sliding to? And just to add, it seems that ironically, and of course non-willingly, Russia seems to be like a beneficiary of this situation, because for our budget, as a Russian citizen, I can say for our budget, high oil prices, they play in our hand. But it seems that again, the United States was shooting in their own foot, because now American citizens are facing soaring oil prices, and Trump was promising them low oil prices. So how would it all unfold? What do you think?
I'm old enough to remember October 1973. That was the war I alluded to beforehand, when Syrian and Egyptian armed forces attacked Israel. And it was then that the United States intervened on behalf of Israel. And in reaction to that, U.S. support the Arab states of OPEC, of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, in October 1973 said, stopping all oil exports to warring factions, which was the U.S., which was the United Kingdom, Germany, not France. France was excluded back then, interestingly. What happened in 1973? The oil price went up by four times in three weeks. We see now an oil price that goes up 30-40%, but it's not 400%. We might see it, I don't think so, but what I think we will see, and this would be the real problem then for many oil consumers, it's not only about the price. Price is something. But what we saw in 1973 and what we might see, not yet a reality, but we might see a physical shortage of oil. Because currently they are putting the so-called strategic petroleum reserve on the market in order to keep the prices under some sort of control. How long does this petroleum reserve last in the U.S.? 26 days. Then it's over. The International Energy Agency is asking its member states to open their stocks. These stocks are for 60 days. And these stocks were created after the 1973 experience, because they wanted to have some sort of buffer in order to counter the scenario of a physical shortage of oil. Now, if you put these oil stocks now on the market, 60 days, 2 months, and then it's over. So that is, in my opinion, the real issue, physical shortage of oil. This is one answer to your question. The other topic that you asked me, whether the Russian Federation is the indirect beneficiary, I am not so sure, you know, because yes, oil prices go up and down. There is some more money inflowing. This is one thing. But let us not underestimate the overall problem of what is going on in West Asia. We have a tremendous chaos now within BRICS. BRICS countries fighting each other there, you know, in terms of United Arab Emirates, Arab countries versus Iran. We have the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is all about energy and security, of which China, Iran, Russia, and some Central Asians are members. What can they do? You know, China is interested in stability in order to prosper. We have to come back to the drama of people. We have Iranians trying to escape Iran, Tehran, and Tehran is very much to the north. You can walk to the Turkish border. I know people who in the early 1980s walked, went on foot from Iran to Turkey. So we might see humanitarian dramas that could also affect Russia. You know, they could destabilize the Southern Caucasus. So I know that some people are making headlines like, oh, this is now good for Russia. I don't think so. No, if you go beyond the whole oil price scenario. Oil price, it's what? It's money for a few days. But the larger picture for me is more fragile.
I wanted to ask you kind of a more existential question about, you have such a long background with diplomacy and education. You educate people about, you know, geopolitics. I'm coming from my perspective. I don't know if you will agree, but I feel like there's been an unraveling of diplomacy in the West, particularly I'm American. So coming from America, that perspective. The sanctions are not a diplomatic tool, though America calls it that. To me, it's like the carrot and the stick. It's a very old-fashioned way of doing business. And they're kind of like overlaying that into diplomacy. The sanctions are punitive. They undervalue trust. I feel like this latest pattern of behavior by Trump, what he's been doing is negotiating, and then in the middle of negotiations, he'll bomb as a surprise. And I feel that this is very destructive overall in the world of approaching diplomacy. What are your thoughts from, you know, watching the West and what's been unfolding historically the last 10, 15 years?
Sorry, Dave, if I may jump in, because now Dmitry, Russian presidential negotiator on the economic track, he's just back from Florida. And from what we've heard, now the United States are discussing lifting the oil sanctions
for 30
on
days.
Russia. In Russia, yeah. So, I mean, when needed, they can be lifted. When needed, they can be put back. So it's like playing a weird game with the sanctions.
Yeah, they are now on the oil sanctions and the oil price ceiling and all that. There's a weird game going on. But let us go more to the principles of all that. The craft of diplomacy. I'm not speaking of the art. You know, the art is like... Yeah. But the regular craft of diplomacy, which means keeping up regular contact, keeping on speaking terms. This is really the essence. This craft has been dying a slow death over the last 25-30 years.
Okay.
And the diplomacy is now in coma. You know, ever since 2022, it went into coma. I published my book on diplomacy in 2020. Mm-hmm. And just a short footnote on that, I started writing my manuscript in 2002. I've never taken so much time to write a book. Usually I can do that in 1 or 2 years. But I wrote that book if you want for 20 years because it took me a while to find a publisher. I was redrafting, starting again and again. And In 2017, I was about to submit my manuscript to the publisher, but then I was appointed Minister of Foreign Affairs, expert minister, not any kind of party politics. I could not submit my manuscript, lucky me, because when I came back to diplomacy as a practitioner, you know, not as an academic who speaks in think tanks about some ideal scenario of diplomacy, but as a practitioner, when I attended my first EU Council of Foreign Ministers, I was shocked. I was shocked by the low level that was in the room. I have my own déformation professionnelle, you know, I'm the teacher. So I looked at people with teacher's eyes, and I put like B minus, C minus, F, you know. The only one who got a good grade on my little note was Boris Johnson. He was the only one who could speak in complete sentences. But all the others were even unable to phrase a sentence, to put some substance in the sentence. So what I saw there was that what I call the craft of diplomacy was gone. And ever since 2022, when the EU said Russia will be defeated on the battlefield, there will not be any diplomatic approach, so bye-bye diplomacy. Mm-hmm. Anybody who was favor of diplomacy, speaking of diplomacy, was a collaborator of Russia, was a Russian agent. It happened to me, that happened to many others. So diplomacy has been killed. I gave a lecture in St. Petersburg. The first year I was there, I called it "Who Kills Diplomacy?" You know, because there are many suspects in the room. Right now, I don't see diplomacy at work. It's a showdown. It's a military showdown, and I don't see much marche de manoeuvre for those who would negotiate. Yes, there are phone calls between Moscow and Washington. Yes, there are phone calls between Tehran and Moscow. There's a lot of consular activity going on, also in evacuating citizens, which is important for any country. But how to regain a priority, a primacy of diplomacy and all that, apologies, I don't see. And again, I put myself into the shoes of the Iranians. If I were an Iranian official, I would not see any use in diplomacy right now because they are under bombs. There is no restriction whatsoever in terms of respecting the basic rules of warfare by the U.S. and by Israel. So why should you?
Karen, since our time is really running out fast, and you are leading me to a personal question that I was going to ask you, how can they get diplomacy back? Is learning from and listening to real diplomats like yourself, but first they almost expelled you from your homeland. I mean, you had to leave the country, so you were almost expelled. And now, from what I know, your citizenship is under the procedure of cancellation. So can you give our viewers some details? What's going on? Why is it happening now? And really, like a European citizen can lose his or her citizenship like out of the blue like that? Is there such a procedure?
Good question. In June 23, when I was appointed to establish the Gorky, this do tank, it's not a think tank, this do tank that I built up with my colleagues in St. Petersburg, there were already voices in Austria raised, for instance, by the former Austrian ambassador to Russia, Mr. Blix, but also by the dean, the former dean of the Faculty of Law, Mr. Meyer, whom I know. I was a student, and afterwards we also worked together on a project, so they know me. They know me quite well. And in 2023, their argument was Karin Kneisel has started to work for a Russian institution, so her passport has to be revoked. Because they consider, their argument is that working for a Russian university equals working for the Russian state. It's as if I were in the Russian armed forces. You know, it's as if I were mercenary. So this is the argument of 2023, which they also use now. There's a government party. It's a so-called liberal party. It's not really liberal. It's something else. And they are now coming up with the same argument. I am working for a Russian university, which is a no-go. Plus, they are now building up the most absurd third-class spy thriller, which means that I had been recommended to the KGB since 1993. I had been a KGB asset for more than 30 years. And as a KGB agent, I turned Minister of Foreign Affairs. So this is now what they are claiming. They are building up a very, very weird but very true story. And this is now the breaking news over the last 3 days in the Austrian media landscape. There is no talk about Austrian mafia money going via Hungary to Kiev. There is no talk about the economic crisis the country is going through. No, it's all about Karin Kneißl working in Russia. How much is my income that all this is whatever? So this is the current state. Now, to come to this precise question of can they just revoke your citizenship? It's interesting for me, but it's also sobering, it's frightening that they even launch a procedure. Because no terrorist in Austria who has killed scores of people has ever been revoked citizenship. I was defending terrorists who had just one citizenship. I said, we cannot take away their citizenship. The United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, says in Article 9, every human being has the right to nationality. What the Austrian authorities are apparently trying to do, I'm not saying they will do, but the procedure has been launched. There is no big debate in Austria. I'm the culprit. And I don't know my crime, except that I teach at a Russian university and that I give interviews to you, because also this, of course, is a no-go. So they want to make me stateless. I have only one citizenship, it's Austrian. And I'm not aiming to have another citizenship. I've served my country for 40 years. I'm 61.
Yeah.
Why should I now, you know, change citizenship? By the way, I was always against dual citizenship. At the Gorky, we will do a big debate next week on that topic. So I am faced with the scenario of being stateless. Now, let us assume I'm stateless. And even if I'm now just an ordinary Austrian, I'm an ordinary Austrian, but I happen to be a foreign minister, I happen to be a diplomat. It could be anybody. It could be a hairdresser in Austria. So if they do that to me, there's plan B. The United Nations foresees for stateless people traveling documents. So I could apply for a UN passport for a stateless person. Now, let us assume, just a scenario, I do that. That would mean, because why were these UN documents done for stateless persons? Because in the 1930s and 40s, you had totalitarian countries like Austria, which kicked out tens of thousands of the citizens. So that these people have travel documents, the United Nations, after 1945, issued these documents for those people who had lost their passports, their Austrian passports. The Austrian government claims that I am harming the reputation of my country. I don't know how I am harming the reputation of my country. I think that if they really push through the citizenship case, and if Karin Kneißl then, for the next few years of my life, whatever remains, will be traveling with a UN document as a stateless person, my question is, who is harming more the reputation? Because Austria happens to be seat of the United Nations.
Well, it feels like insanity rules the world, right? I mean, in Europe, in the United States, it feels like insanity rules the world. But I really hope that since you say that you are all over the Austrian news, at least maybe some people read your articles and listen to your lectures, because most of your predictions, they were very reasonable and they came true. So at least let's hope for that. But that's what we have time for. Really, thank you for being with us. And for our viewers, please stay involved, share your questions, your guest ideas. They're already coming, so we'll try to invite more guests you suggest.
And we'll see you next time. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. See you.